Welcome to the ultimate crowdsourced personal finance show. This is your Friday Roundup.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, you made it. The weekend is almost here. This is your Friday Roundup. And to help me do this episode today, I have my co-host, Brad, here with me in the studio. How you doing, Brad?
You know, I am doing great, Jonathan. How about you, man?
I'm doing fantastic. I am having the time of my life with this. Literally every single week, I get more excited about this podcast. And it's 100% due to the engagement from our community.
Yeah, I hear you. It's really very cool opening up our email inbox or, you know, going on Twitter or Facebook and just seeing these comments and seeing, and it's not just these short little pithy thing. It's people writing paragraphs, people writing pages, telling us about their story. And it's really, really cool.
And just the fact that the stuff that we're trying to get across to people, we want to convey information that has the power to change lives, that can be implemented, that we've already thought out and distilled, and we're trying to communicate it to you in a way that personally I would understand. And I need things to be very clear. I don't like things that are opaque. I need things that I can take that information and you give me five steps and I can do it and I can visualize it. And I think people are appreciating that. And so some of the emails we've gotten are people saying, hey, you know, I've listened to every single one and I've implemented these five things and here's where I'm at and I'm loving it. That is so powerful to me.
Yeah, I totally hear you there. I think what's cool is that we're not holding ourselves out to be experts. We obviously have a pretty significant baseline of information here, but we're doing research. We're getting guests on. We're just trying to convey this in the simplest manner possible. And I think that resonates with people. And I think also, frankly, like the fact that you and I are similar in many regards, but dramatically different in others, I think that's pretty cool. Like, I think the different perspectives, some people see themselves as the Jonathans, you know, sometimes some people see themselves as the Brad. Like, I think that's cool. So yeah, hopefully everybody out there is enjoying. I can tell you for sure that we are.
Couldn't agree more. And to our audience, a huge thank you for all of your support. So this past Monday, we had the episode with Justin from Root of Good. And I mean, it really was incredible to take a look at financial independence. You know, when you've actually done it, and what does that look like for your kids? How does that directly affect your relationship with them? How you grow them and mentor them through this process? What does that framework actually look like? And Justin did a wonderful job unpacking it. And he's obviously living it, so it was very easy for him. But I enjoyed just talking to him about it. I'd been reading some of his content and it was exciting for him to kind of bring it to life and turn it into a story with us.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I was struck by the fact that Justin is just like a really chill guy, right? Like, it just sounds like he has this nice, relaxing, happy life with his family down there. And that just really, it just hit me that this is what life is all about, is trying to find what you enjoy. And all of us are going to enjoy dramatically different things. You might have your golf membership, Jonathan. I might be playing soccer or doing jujitsu or something. And we all just enjoy different things. Justin might have his feet up on the hammock, like we joked about, right?
Yeah.
His pasty feet.
He's done that to me at least twice more since that episode was recorded.
But right, doesn't it just seem like he has that really just chill life?
It really does. And he gets to spend a lot of time with his kids and with his family. And, you know, when you think about it, when you think about what that process actually looked like for him, it was really just about a 10-year journey, right? I mean, he said he graduated, I think, at what, 23?
Yeah.
And it was a 10-year process for him to get to financial independence. And so now he's 3 to 6 years into that. And that is not an inconceivable amount of time. So there are certainly people that are getting this information and they're in their teens. And if they grab onto this, they're listening to the episodes, they incorporate just a few of the things that we talk about, they're going to be financially independent by the time they're 30. But there's some people that are hearing it that are just now, you know, hearing this stuff for the first time and they're in their 30s, 35, 45. And you know, that's also totally fine. You know, get yourself out of debt. once you get yourself out of debt, you're looking at, you could probably do this within 10 years without really making that many changes outside of just optimizing your life. You could do this in 10 years. It's not rocket science. The math works for you. And what we're just trying to show you is how the math works and how you can get ahead on this thing.
Yeah. And that is a key point that, you know, I don't want people out there listening who are in their 40s or 50s even, and, you know, who maybe have some debt or have too big of a mortgage. I don't want them to say, oh, this isn't for me. Because it is for you. It's for everyone. I mean, this is just about making simple life changes that when you add together 5, 10, 20 of them are going to make a huge difference. And, you know, I agree with Jonathan exactly. Like, the math just works. It's, I would think 10 to 15 years realistically for most people, you can become financially independent if you make those changes. And you know what? Honestly, like, maybe you can't make the 20 big changes or medium-sized changes that we'd love for you to make in a perfect world. Well, you know what? Make two of them. Make five of them and put a couple $1,000 extra a year in your bank account. That is going to make a whole lot of difference to you psychologically over the course of years, right? I mean, you might not be truly financially independent after the 10 years in this perfect world scenario, but you're going to be a lot more comfortable. And that means something. So this information is for everyone. It's not for 22-year-old kids who haven't made any wrong choices and have the whole world ahead of them. It's for everyone.
And if you're listening to this episode, this is the first episode you've ever listened to, I just wanted to let you know we've actually created a free infographic series for you. We put it together as an ebook, again, totally free. But what it's going to help you do is really dive into the content that we've produced up to this point and will produce in the future and aggregate these big ideas for you so you can pick and choose, you know, what you really want to dive into and what actions you want to take. But the key here is that you take action. So take me up on this offer, get started today. Go to choosefi.com/start to access that infographic series and get started on your own path to financial independence. One of the things that I love about our community and what we do, we're always talking about changing your compass. And instead of trying to keep up with the Joneses, try to keep up with a person that's pursuing financial independence. Change your compass. And so if I wanted to be more like Justin, I'm not going to focus on getting the brand new car. I'm not going to focus on getting the brand new house that the Joneses are purchasing, that's the McMansion. I'm going to focus on increasing my savings rate. I'm going to focus on efficiency on cars. I'm going to focus on efficiency with kids and keeping all that budget in line. I'm not going to spend $300,000 to raise one child. I'm going to try and do that in a more optimized, efficient way. I know we both love that quote. If you're going to be average, it's going to cost you $300,000 to raise a child. It's not going to cost me that much. I guarantee it.
Yeah, no doubt. And I actually wrote down that quote, and it's people who live an average lifestyle, they just do dumb stuff, suboptimal things when it comes to spending. So if you want to be average, it's going to cost you about $300,000. But if you want to make cost-effective choices, it's going to cost a lot less than that. And that was just a brilliant quote by Justin.
You know, I actually was reading a news article recently. This article was saying that the Joneses were based on this family that had this massive mansion. And it just popped up in the news recently that they actually had a foreclosure on that home. So even the Joneses of the Joneses go bankrupt trying to keep up with themselves. So I love that I'm trying to be more like Brad. I'm trying to be more like Justin. I'm trying to be more like Millionaire Educator. I'm trying to model my tax returns and my finances around these more optimized, streamlined paths. And when these are your mentors, these are the people that you're getting ideas from, you cannot help but fall into wealth over time. You know, and it's like JD says, it's not getting rich quickly. You know, I don't have that strategy for you. I'm never going to send you down to the 7-Eleven to go get the lottery ticket and then tell you that the real key is to play these certain numbers. But get rich slowly, you can do that every time. And it actually doesn't take as long as you think once you understand the simple math of early retirement. So what we're building here, we're building a framework. One of the things that I'm super excited about, we are starting the conversation on how to hack college. We know that college is inefficient. We know that it's this bloated model. And to be honest, nobody has really put together a great set of resources for how to do college the smart way. And probably a lot of that is because most of the FIRE community is over the age of 30, and we're too young to have kids that are in college right now, but we're too old to have to worry about it ourselves. So it's kind of this, maybe the self-interest type thing that promotes a lot of the material that we produce. But because we're talking about hacking college, and because we're getting to a point where we're having to start thinking about it for our kids, people are coming forward and telling us we have these really cool ideas. And one of them is Edmund T, who's now a contributor at ChooseFI. He's going to be helping us. He's going to be writing a lot of content about different type of life hacks and how to hack college. And he is producing an article series right now that shows how he got his son through college in half the time for a fraction of the cost. And that's going to be a mind-blowing article when he publishes that. He's working on it right now. And also Sun Wu, who I've told y'all about before, he took that podcast that we just did and is using that as the inspiration for him to actually go back to the drawing board. And he is going to completely show you how to hack the FAFSA. So if you have kids that are going to be going to college in the next several years, stay tuned. We are going to be getting that content out to you and then pointing you to it when it's produced. But the FI community has gotten really good at learning what the rules are and then learning how to channel them to their advantage. And all you have to do is know how to find that information and then incorporate it into your life. And we're going to try to take care of those first two steps for you by showing you exactly where that content is and then doing our best to distill it into information that you can absorb and actually use. And I think that's the power of what Brad and I are trying to do here every single Monday and Friday that we get on this podcast.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I cannot wait to see the information that Ed and Sun Wu put out. I know it's funny. I'm such a long-term thinker. My older daughter is in third grade now. So she's 8 years old. And while it doesn't seem like a right around the corner, it's 10 years from now, she's going to go to college. And 10 years is going to go by in a blink of an eye. But if I can plan now, and this is the beauty, like you just alluded to, of being in this FIRE community, is we know the rules and we try to figure out how to make them work best for us. So if I can start now in March of 2017 planning for how can I hack the FAFSA 10 years from now, well, that might inform my financial decisions for the next 10 years. If that can help us save a couple $100,000 potentially on college just by being smart, right? That might mean paying off my mortgage. You know, I don't know what the answer is, but it might mean if your home equity is excluded, that might mean paying off my mortgage with cash that I have sitting in my normal taxable funds, because it would count towards our college contribution if it was sitting in taxable funds, but it wouldn't count in home equity. Well, of course I'm going to pay it off. But, you know, that's just right off the top of my head. But, you know, I'm so, so endlessly fascinated by this because the dollar figures are just so enormous, you know? And yeah, I just kind of wanted to pivot back real, real quick to the keeping up with the Joneses there for a second and just kind of throw my two cents in, which is the people who drive around and looking like they're rich, in my estimation, are generally poor. And I don't consider if you're rich by how much money you make. It's, to me, it's how much money you save and what your net worth is. And it doesn't matter if you make $30,000 a year or $200,000 a year. That is not the line, the market delineation for who's rich and who's not, the income. It's how much they save. Because, you know, frankly, like when my brother graduated college, he was living at home. He hadn't gotten this was years ago, of course, but hadn't gotten a full-time job yet. And he was just waiting tables. But he was saving essentially 90% of his income. And he had, at that point, you know, I don't know the exact number, but let's say he was able to save up $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, some big number, right? And like, you know, people would look at him as, oh, he's waiting tables at, I don't even know where it was, Ruby Tuesdays or something like that. Like, he must be poor. But he probably had more in net worth than the executive driving around in a BMW 5 Series with their, you know, stupid McMansion, right? Because those bozos don't save any money. It's about making those right choices and saving money. So obviously I can be a little harsh sometimes calling people bozos and things, but it's not about income. That's what I want to stress to you. It's about saving money and just being a little bit smarter than the next guy. So that's how I live my life. And I think it's important. I think it's valuable.
And I found the exact article, and it says a dilapidated New York mansion believed to have inspired the phrase keeping up with the Joneses has sold at auction for $120,000. Long Island-based Maltz Auction says that the 24-room Wincliffe Castle sold Wednesday. It was built in 1853 in Rhinebeck as the country house of a Manhattan socialite, Elizabeth Sherhermanhorn Jones, a member of a wealthy family and aunt of the American novelist Edith Wharton. The property's elegance is said to have prompted the owners of the nearby Hudson Valley estates to build even bigger mansions, giving birth to the idiom keeping up with the Joneses. Wincliffe fell into disrepair under various owners and was abandoned in the 1950s. So there's the original article. We'll post it in the show links.
That's great.
Yeah, it's kind of just cool. You know, not cool. I'm sure it's sad for them, but it's kind of cool for you to be able to visualize the fact that the Joneses can't keep up with the Joneses. And why try?
Yep. Agreed. And yeah, just going back to the Justin podcast real quick, is we talked a lot about kids, and are your kids going to be okay if they don't see you working hard at your work? Or are they going to be entitled? Are they going to learn how money works? And I just find those questions so short-sighted. I know we kind of read them in a sarcastic manner of Justin set up these questions on his post and continued to go on and refute them essentially. And I completely agree with him. I just don't understand why people conflate working so many hours at your, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 to 6 or whatever it may be with working hard. And especially with your kids seeing that. Your kids simply don't see it. They have no idea if you're sitting there with your legs on the desk, napping in your chair all day, or if you're actually doing something productive with the world. Kids, and I know I mentioned this in the episode, the only thing that kids care about is spending time with you. And anything that keeps you away from them is a detriment to them, in my estimation. You know, obviously that the caveat is you need to make money, right? You need to have the minimum essentials taken care of. And you know, I'm very cognizant of that. I'm in a very fortunate position. I don't want to cast aspersions on people who have to work hard or work multiple jobs. Those aren't the people I'm talking about. But your children just want to spend time with you. They don't need expensive presents. They don't need expensive cars or houses. They just want to hang out with you with your phone away and, you know, you to be not distracted. That's what I've found is the secret to raising kids. And I fall down on this all the time. I have my stupid phone with me sometimes and I catch myself and I put it away. But it's just about that time. So, Jonathan, I know you have a baby coming in about a month here. So if you can take any value from that comment at all, hopefully keep it in mind in the next couple of years.
No, I actually really am. So, for instance, so I don't have any kids right now. I have this one that's going to be born in the next month. And so I don't necessarily feel the pressing obligation to have my phone off at certain times, but you hold me accountable on that. It's actually hilarious and awesome. And I'm like, wow, I need to channel that because I know there's value there. And so I'll text Brad on like a weekend, you know, to talk about something that we want to do on Monday, or I'll say, hey, can we schedule a call? And, you know, Brad will actually say, actually, I set aside this time for my kids and I can't do it today. And it's amazing. It's awesome. I mean, it's, to me, that would be, I would find that so challenging, but at the same time, I find it inspiring that you have reserved this time for your kids and for your family, and you just, you check out and you don't think about work for that period of time. And that's powerful. I'm one of these people that probably always has trouble finding balance in life. I get so 100% committed to something that everything else falls away. And I love that you maintain that as you take on new thing and you find new passions that are going to absorb your time. You still try to carve out that time so that it doesn't eat into, you know, the obviously the most important thing, which is being there for your family.
Yeah, thank you. That definitely brought a smile to my face when you're saying it. It's something that I work hard at, and I think it's important. And I think people out there listening can take some value from this. And you know, listen, I'm not perfect. I'm not perfect in anything. I screw up with this all the time, but I do make a concerted effort when it's the weekend. I don't have my phone on. I try, like, my big goal on a Saturday is to literally not turn on my computer because I know what I'll do. Every time I walk past the bedroom, I'll just zip in, check my email. I don't know, check some stat on my website or something that's just so inane and doesn't add any value to my life. But I know I will do it. So what I do is I just don't turn it on. Or every night at 8 o'clock is when I try to do this. I shut my phone off, literally shut the phone off. I shut my computer down. And if I get an email after 8 o'clock, well, I'm not going to check it, you know, because I know what'll happen. I'll get something that'll be, oh, I have to answer it real quickly, or, oh, it's something went wrong, or somebody left a nasty comment on my Facebook page or something, you know, just something stupid. And like, it can wait until the morning. It just can. And like, I get to spend that extra hour with my daughter, Anna, and not be distracted and not be worried about what's going on. Because you know what? I don't care what's going on my computer. I really don't. And yeah, hopefully people can get some value from that.
I guarantee you my wife is going to listen to this podcast and just start shaking her finger at me. Yes, preach it, brother. Preach it. I hope you hear this, Jonathan. Right. Did you hear him? Yes. Yes, we heard. I heard it. That's awesome. I'm gonna do that.
Nice. Tell her I'll try to help.
You do.
If you email me at 7:45,
he does not answer.
Shut it
down. He does not answer. Yep. And now I know why.
Nice. Okay. That's awesome.
So we always like to spend some time just talking about the content, and I loved it. I love this idea of second generation fire. We are going to be committed over the next several years to delivering content that is transformative for middle class America that wants to build wealth one life hack at a time. And part of that has to be the focus on the second generation. So we opened that conversation. We've opened the college hacking conversation. We're incredibly excited about both. Content, Brad and I, we don't just stop. Like, we don't just interview somebody and then that's it. You never hear about it again. We just move on. We're always building and growing. And so when we miss something, when you want to correct something, if you want to add something to the conversation, this is a community-driven show. And so when you give us extra content that completes that picture, we then come back and we address it and we talk about it and we use it to get these ideas out there. And then what we're trying to do is just over time, as more and more ideas come in from us, from contributors, from bloggers, from other podcasters, and from our audience, we try to put this together into a story that builds and gives you actionable content that you can take with you. So, I hope you appreciate that. I hope it's one of those things where you literally want to hear every single episode starting from the first one, because you can see how each additional episode is giving you new information that you can fit into your own journey.
In that same vein, it's important to know that this is a journey, and we want and need you guys to be there with us along this journey, because we are not ultra experts on every single topic. We are not infallible by any means. We talk about things as we see it and as we know it. So these comments that we're getting from you guys, they're really crucial. We actually received one from Keith from Singapore in response to our roundup last week, and where we talked about investing in a bubble and moving all your money to Vanguard potentially. And he said, with regards to the reader's worry about deploying capital in a quote bubble, I think this is where the answers can be more refined by bringing on some guests to talk about the nuances of this. I believe those folks that are closer to FI or building and accumulating would face different challenges. When you're near the end, it is better not to have a massive drawdown. Research for a lot of the 4% rule is done on a model portfolio of 60-40 or 50-50 stock and bond allocation. If there is a massive drawdown in the first 5 years, your plan will be severely affected. Not my words, but from the folks researching this. And this is a really insightful comment. And, you know, I think the one caveat is, of course, we're talking about this stuff very much in passing, and it is hard to get down, to dive down into the nuance. So I completely agree with that. And, you know, you don't want to give short shrift to anything, obviously, especially when we're talking really technical stuff. But so I greatly appreciate the comment. And I think we will get people on to talk about the nuance of this, because it is important. You know, that's touching on the people who have essentially reached FI or who are close. And that's a significant and important segment of our audience. So yeah, without question, that's something we'll talk about. But I also did want to kind of take a step back and just talk about how I approach life, which is generally through simplicity. And that doesn't mean I don't deal with nuance or the technical aspects of things, but I don't want to let the perfect be the enemy of the good here. So in that instance, I don't want people saying, okay, I'm going to leave my funds at this crappy investment company that, you know, is charging me loads on commission loads and multiple percent expense ratios just because there's a bubble, whereas they're invested anyway. And if they can move the money to Vanguard and still be invested, but at, you know, a 0.05% expense ratio, that's a dramatically better situation than where they are currently. So that's kind of where I approach the question. And, you know, I do appreciate the point of view, certainly, that there is nuance to this. There unquestionably is. But sometimes in life, like, a lot of people get hung up and know they should make decisions and they know they should take action, but they just don't do it. So to me, it's about, how can I get people to take action? And sometimes that just means getting the ball rolling and taking the right choice. And that might even mean, for that person who's scared of the bubble, that might mean moving their funds out of that expensive investment advisor and just moving them to Vanguard in a cash account and then investing, like you said, Jonathan, on a dollar cost averaging basis over 6 weeks, 6 months, 2 years, whatever it is, whatever they're comfortable with. At the end of the day, I don't care about that. I just care that they take action. That is the crucial part. So again, great comment and thank you. And hopefully my point of view makes sense as well.
And you know how many times you hear something, but because it sounds, even though you know it will benefit your life, because it sounds just a little bit too complicated, or there's some part of it that you're not sure about, you just don't do anything. And I think that's what we're about. We're trying to lower the barrier to entry. We're trying to give you an idea about what that first step looks like, and then that next step, and then that next step. And some of the feedback that we've gotten for people, it seems to me that that is what we're communicating. Cause I've had probably three or four comments come through where they basically said, since I've been listening to your show, I've done X, Y, Z, and I've listened to tons of other shows, but I've never actually been able to commit and get started to something, but it somehow seems more manageable the way y'all are putting it together. And I can relate to that. That's the exact way that it is in my life. And I need to know what that first step is. And after you take the first step, you can figure out, you know, how to get more sophisticated with it. You can figure out all these allocation models as you get into your 50s and 60s. And you know, I think we're going to try to explore a little bit more of that as we get farther down this journey. We have Jim Collins coming on, and we're going to talk about some different allocation models. But I think just getting started, like Brad said, is so critical. And hopefully, you know, up till now, we've done enough to give you the motivation to do that. Okay, Brad, so we do have another question, and this is from Paul. He wants to know where to put our savings. And I think this one is a good one for you, just because you're struggling with the same thing. So when you mentioned saving money, where should that go? Savings account, money market, mutual fund, IRA. I wouldn't think a savings account would be beneficial with the low interest rate. A money market would be better, but it's not ideal. Should I do a mix of all of these or maybe something else? I'm ready to save, but just not sure where the savings should go. We have a few thousand dollars in savings, but I really want it to work for us better than the less than 1% interest. I also don't want it to be too accessible because it would be too tempting. Thanks, and I'm really enjoying the podcast, Paul.
Yeah, that's a great question, my Paul. And Jonathan, I think you and I will have different answers to this, right? When we talk about where our emergency funds are and you having one or you not having one, excuse me, and me having one, et cetera. But I'll try to touch on this real quick. So where does savings go? I think the easiest place to just get started, and like we've been talking about, just take action, is open an online bank account. I think we have Capital One 360, and that kind of touches all the bases, which is, you know, it has the best quote unquote interest or thereabouts, pretty close. It's still a tiny under 1%, but it's also fairly inaccessible because, you know, you're linking it to your checking account and you're just sending it out to this other bank account. And Capital One is not the only one that has it. There's plenty, and we'll link to a couple of them in the show notes, certainly. But the money is really out of reach then. You have to physically go in and then initiate the transfer in order to get it back into your checking account. So just setting up that little bit of discomfort might prove to be like a decent psychological barrier to, like Paul said, a little too tempting to access it. So that's like a real simple thing. I think without knowing Paul's perfect situation, is it's hard to know, like, these couple thousand bucks that he has saved. Is that your entire emergency fund? Or, you know, if you got a flat tire, Paul, or, you know, something like that, or the air conditioner broke in your house, like, is this the money that you're talking about? Because that might inform the decision a little bit. What I probably would do is I would open up a Vanguard account, or like we talked about previously, it could be Schwab, it could be Fidelity, but my bias is towards Vanguard. And I would open up an investing account. It's a regular, what we call it, a taxable account. That's just a regular savings account or investment account where it's not your pre-tax dollars. It's not your 401k. It's not an IRA. It's just the money that you've saved and you want to invest. You'll hear us generally refer to that as your taxable savings, because it's money that the investment dividends and capital gains would be taxable. But that's just known as a taxable account. That's just your traditional savings and investments. So, and I would get started. Probably the easiest way would be with a low-cost ETF, which is an exchange-traded fund. It's similar, very similar to a mutual fund in the sense that it owns a potentially hundreds or thousands of underlying stocks just in that ETF. So the reason why I would start with an ETF is the expense ratios are tiny on them. It's very comparable, if not better, than the mutual funds. But there's no minimum. So it's whatever the share price of that ETF is, and they're generally under $100, and from what I've seen, maybe the total stock market index fund, you know, under $200. So you could buy shares in increments of $100 or $200, whatever the price is that day. Whereas some of the Vanguard mutual funds have a minimum of, let's say, $3,000 to invest. So just going back to that taking action, right? If you have to save up $3,000 to make that first purchase, you might not do that. That might be an insurmountable hurdle, right? Or it might just be that psychological hurdle that stops you from taking action. So, you know, maybe go into Vanguard and just buy a share. buy 2 shares of the total stock market ETF. That's a pretty good starting point. And what Jonathan talks about is the dollar cost averaging, which is just kind of buying on a regular basis. And what it essentially does is when the stock price is down, you can buy a little bit more with that same amount. Let's say you can invest $200 a week or, you know, whatever it is, $100 a week. And, you know, you could buy a little bit more when the stock price is down, a little bit less when the stock price is up, but you're averaging yourself into it as opposed to dumping every dollar of your savings in life into the stock market on one day. And then, you know, the next day the market goes down a couple percent and you're freaking out, right? Like, because that's the psychological hurdle of investing for people is looking at it. And that's why, you know, I mentioned in a prior packet, like, I don't look at this stuff. I try to avoid it because I know it will cause me psychological issues. And, you know, it sucks when you see your money go down, but you have to know this is a 20 to 40 year play. And this is, as far as we know, the best way to gain wealth over decades. So that's a very long-winded way of saying, you know, what I would do is some combination of just an online bank if you need money that you can access in a fairly short order, a couple days, or, you know, Vanguard. And, you know, realistically, you could do the same with Vanguard. You could sell those funds or those ETFs and just transfer the money back to your bank account, and it might take you an extra day. So it's actually pretty comparable to the savings. But I know for some people, there is that hurdle of actually selling, and that might be like a slippery slope to doing that more often. You know, I wouldn't suggest putting your money in investments and selling every time you needed to get new tires on your car or something. That's just not a good way to go about it. So if it were me, I would have some combination of just an emergency fund in a savings account, and the rest of the money I would funnel into Vanguard.
Yeah. And actually, Brad, I have one more tip. You know, I kind of did some vetting around. I looked at the online savings account. We actually set up a program with CIT Bank. CIT Bank, it's a phenomenal online savings account. And they're actually offering one of the best interest rates in the market right now. Now, it's variable, so depending on what goes on with the market, that it can fluctuate. But I mean, it's a phenomenal 1.75% interest rate. I know that historically, when I look at like my USAA savings account, it was so abysmally low, like 0.05% or something. I mean, 1.75% is incredible. So if you're, you know, setting aside $3,000, $6,000, $10,000 or more in a savings account, make sure that you're getting a good rate on that. And if you want to use CIT, we've actually set up a short code for you. You can just go to chooseify.com/CIT. You have to have a minimum amount of $100, and then you need to be saving at least $100 a month to lock in that interest rate. But that's a great place to store your emergency fund or cash bucket if you have one. Again, that's chooseify.com/CIT, and they are an affiliate of this program. So if you use our link, you're directly supporting the show at no cost to yourself. And then personally for myself, like, I'm in this wealth accumulation phase. I'm not close to drawdown right now. I'm not relying on this money. So I'm not going to keep $60,000, $70,000, $120,000 like sitting in cash at this particular point in time. Like, that doesn't make sense for me. So, you know, beyond this kind of, you know, modest emergency fund, I'm just trying to get everything I can into the market. And I want to get it in as quickly as possible and have it in there for as long as possible with this long-term buy and hold mindset.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, also we've talked previously, Jonathan, how I'm kind of over-invested in cash, and because of whatever reason, you know, just being conservative with our money or lazy or inertia, whatever it may be. And I'm proud to say one of my little wins of the week here was I actually took action and moved a pretty sizable amount of money out of our, like, quote unquote emergency fund and moved it to Vanguard to add to our positions in VTSAX. Thanks, man. Yeah, it was cool. It was, you know, it's just one of those things. Like, I was looking at our financial spreadsheets, our net worth spreadsheets, and I'm like, come on, like, you know, you're giving advice to people out in the world and you're over invested in cash. And I know that it's stupid. I know that it is, but like, there's some part, there must be some like genetic part in me that like just needs to like squirrel away this money and like, right, you know, have it for like just some catastrophe, even though like, I know intellectually, like if there's a catastrophe, I could just sell my VTSAX and get access to it then, right? But like, and I know, obviously, intellectually, that over the course of years and decades, that money is going to be essentially losing value sitting in a checking account or a savings account because of even minor inflation. Whereas it's a way to grow wealth when you haven't invested in the stock market. So that's the kind of, hopefully that's kind of a cool thing for the audience, is that like, I'm taking action based on the stuff that we're talking about, because it's so easy to be lazy. It's so easy to be complacent with this, and you just have to take action. So yeah, that was my little win of the week.
Nice. Yeah. We do try to take our own advice when we can. Okay, Brad, so since you were challenged on that, I have another challenge for you. And this was from one of our readers. And I thought this was really good because we did not hit on this. This was from Kevin. And he says, my wife and I are Dave Ramsey graduates. We were able to take his baby steps and walk ourselves out of debt. After being so focused on getting out of debt for 2 years, I felt there was a little emptiness after it was done. I was searching for the next thing, and that's when I found the world of FI. The majority of what Dave Ramsey says, I agree with, but I've lightened my stance on no credit cards. He said, I did hear you say that Dave suggests that you can get an 18% return in the market, but I know he's never said that. He does say that you can get 18% if you stop using credit cards that have a balance and the APR is 18%. Now, I don't exactly agree with Dave's assumption on 12%, but J.L. Collins does say in his book, The Simple Path to Wealth, that from 1975 to 2015, the market average was 11.9%. J.L. Collins does say that he's not suggesting that you can get that, but he does use 11.9% in his assumptions. I think that Dave knows that that's a big number to hit, but he uses that number as a learning tool, and he has some facts to support the number. And he said, when we were getting out of debt, we did stop all retirement contributions, but I don't have a 401k, so I didn't have to worry about getting that free money. After listening to your podcast, I tried to break down the numbers for myself if I did have a 401k, and it would be a tough decision if I would have contributed to it. I think knowing what I know now, I would have stopped all contributions. It just feels great not to be a slave to my debt. And I think that leads into paying off my home. I know a lot of people go into the math on this one, but I'll ask you what Dave asked his callers. If you had a paid for home, would you go out and borrow money at 3% in order to invest it? Because it's the same thing as having a mortgage and not paying it off. So Brad, that's what I want to ask you. If you had a paid for home, would you go out and borrow money at 3% in order to invest it?
Would I? Probably not. Would some people in the FI community, some real smart people in the FI community? I think they would.
Honestly. Yeah, I do think some in the FI community would, but I'm asking you, I'm going to challenge you with this one, because that is one I've heard him say before, and it's such a valid point, and I know how conservative you are. And I know you hadn't heard anybody pose that question to you.
Yeah, no, it's a cool way of looking at it. I mean, no, I wouldn't.
Yeah,
I really wouldn't. You know, the brain side of me knows.
Well, I know you want to pay off your home. I know it's like on your mind, and you're looking for an excuse.
You can hear it in my voice, hopefully. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm fumbling over my words here because I don't know the answer. Honestly, like I struggle with this on a weekly basis, where part of me wants to pay off our mortgage as quickly as we possibly can, and the other rational part of me knows that it's really not smart.
Your cost of living without a mortgage would be like 18 grand a year.
Oh my God, I know. It's crazy. I mean, that is, you know, it's funny because I actually had this conversation with my wife, Laura, was that I almost wanted to set up like a big goal, almost like how you paid off your 168K of student loans, which, you know, as opposed to like, you know, I'm saving a decent amount of money, obviously, you know, I make a decent income and we save 60 or 70% of our income. It's a decent dollar figure, but on some level, it doesn't feel real because the money just gets dumped into an account. Mm-hmm. And there's no like, on it, for me, there's no like satisfaction to that. Whereas like paying down a mortgage, that's something that I could like wrap my arms around. And I know it's silly, and I know you'll have people out there like saying there's no difference with what you're saying. But like for some reason, for me, there is a difference. And like I think it would be cool to say like we had $4,000 extra this month or $1,500 extra this month. Let's pay it off on the mortgage, right? And then you see like every subsequent payment, because it makes every subsequent payment more valuable in essence, because less is going to interest. It changes the amortization schedule a bit. So even if you made one bigger extra payment, it would make every subsequent payment more valuable, which is kind of cool. So to me, there is a deep satisfaction to that. So
I don't expect you to say, yes, I'm going to go pay it off this week, but I knew that would challenge you.
It does. It challenges me on a very, very deep level because, like you said, if we could pay off our mortgages, you know, like I've mentioned before with my biggest mistake, we have some investment mortgages that we're still dealing with, but it's not a massive number. But if we could get rid of our mortgages in general, yeah, our living expenses would be minuscule. They would be Mr. Money Mustache level of certainly below $30,000. You know, unfortunately, we have to, you know, since we're self-employed, we have to pay for healthcare, and that's a big line item. So it wouldn't be the 18K, but it wouldn't be terribly far off from that. And then that makes life just so much easier. Like, you know, if my website's just imploded one day, well, when you only need $30,000 to live, like, you know, Laura does taxes during tax season. You know, she's a CPA and she makes more than that or somewhere in that vicinity. And like, that's pretty cool knowing that, like, even if the worst possible thing happened, yeah, that we'd be fine. Like, that, there is a lot of satisfaction to that. So, yeah, as you can tell, I can go on and on about this, but I wouldn't take out that mortgage to invest, to actually answer his question. And I'm strongly thinking about paying down my mortgage. I think Laura disagrees with that. I think she thinks it's not as smart as I do, but, yeah, we'll see.
If you do end up choosing to do it, I think that would definitely be a frugal win of the week that we could talk about. So
nice.
I remember he does say that, and it is such a valid point. It's so challenging. And I just know how much you're already thinking about it. So I just figured I would hit you with it today and see what popped out.
Yeah, no, it's cool. I appreciate it.
Okay, so we did get a couple iTunes reviews. Actually, we got a lot of iTunes reviews this week, and thank you guys. I mean, close to 47 of you have stopped by iTunes and left us a review so far. So that is amazing. Thank you so much. And if you are interested in leaving us a review, you can just go to our webpage and click on the iTunes button on the sidebar, and it'll take you straight to our page. If you want to leave us a review, you can also just go to the iTunes store and search for Choose FI one word. And then, you know, just leave us a one or two sentence review. I mean, it really helps us out. We're trying to get this message out there. We really think that if you at some point fell in love with Dave Ramsey and you got to debt free or you got close, but then you decided after that, it just feels a little empty and you're looking for that next thing, this is the podcast for you. If you're a life hacker and you just want to do everything as optimized as possible, this is the podcast for you. If you want to basically hear all of the people, all the articles that you've been reading all across the internet from just creators over the last 5 or 10 years, and you want to find a place where those get brought to life and get turned into a conversation, this is the podcast for you. And I love it. I mean, this is what I love to turn these articles, which sometimes, you know, there's good information there, but you have trouble figuring out how to put it into your life. I love turning that into a story and figuring out how can I actually use that information in my life. That's what we're trying to do for you. So Daniel wrote us an iTunes review, and he said, I started listening to this podcast after hearing them on a Radical Personal Finance podcast episode. Since listening to them, I've doubled my 401k savings rate. I got a Chase Sapphire preferred credit card for travel rewards, and I refinanced my student loans to a lower rate, nearly 2 percentage points. Keep up the fantastic work, gentlemen. And then Quinn CR says, so much to say about how fantastic this podcast is. Brad and Jonathan are an amazing duo. Great conversation and concepts. I feel like I'm learning something despite knowing so much about this topic. Great guest. Please keep going. I look forward to new episodes every week. So thank you both for leaving those comments. And then I also told you that one of the things we're trying to do is we want your input about where the show goes. I mean, we think we have ideas. We think we have ideas that will resonate with people, but we're crowdsourcing this. And so Matt suggested he wants us to do one at some point, and he realizes that it's a little bit too soon for this, but to do one on effective altruism. So the idea that at some point, the FI community that's been doing this for 10 years and been implementing these ideas one at a time, they're going to be worth well over $1 million. And you don't need, you know, at some point your money keeps growing due to compound interest, but you don't need all that money in order to provide for your family anymore. You have excess. And because you're very comfortable with this entry-level middle-class lifestyle, what do you do with the excess? And how can you use that to make the world a better place? And I think it's a great idea. You know, that's something we'll look at for down the road. And then, you know, we're also going to get into some conversations about maybe crowdfunding real estate. We have, there's two fellows that we know that maybe Brad can talk about that are actually looking at doing a really cool project down in Georgia. And so I'll let Brad introduce that idea in a second. But also, you know, we're going to go and find some people that are doing kind of peer lending for real estate and looking at that as a potential vehicle. Also, insurance for the FIRE community. You know, what type of insurances do most people in the FIRE community think are essential? And then tax optimization for the FIRE community. How can you take a couple that makes 170 grand a year and then move them down to the point where they have less than 40 grand of taxable income. So, I mean, these are just ideas, but like people have figured it out. So all we have to do, I don't have to come up with the information. We just have to go find the people that have and then figure out how to take all of those really cool ideas and put them into one place that makes this story so that you can figure out that one or two or three ideas you can actually use for yourself. And then we get to hear how those ideas impacted your life. That's the podcast I want to listen to. That's the podcast that Brad and I want to make. So we hope you get as excited about that as I am right now telling you about it.
Yeah, I can hear the excitement in your voice, Jonathan. That's very cool. And yeah, I mean, you know, some of these topics are things that interest me and, you know, dramatically interest me that I just know nothing about. You know, the real estate aspect of things, you know, that is incredibly intriguing to me. And I learned a ton on the Coach Carson house hacking episode that'll drop in a couple of days. And yeah, like Jonathan alluded to, there's this real estate investment that we're both been made aware of, and we're not trying to pitch by any means here to the audience, but our friends who organize the Camp Mustache event down in Florida that we always talk about, Stephen and David, they're actually two brothers. When we were down there, we heard a presentation on co-housing, which is essentially having a community that shares many communal aspects that makes it, instead of just being these little islands unto ourselves that is, you know, what most of suburbia is, unfortunately. You know, we have our big plots of land and you don't really see your neighbors all that much other than just, you know, waving hello to them as you scream by in your car. This is actually making a community where people rely on each other, people get to know each other, and, you know, just all these positive aspects that we've talked about a lot about, like on previous podcasts, where I am, at least in my life now, community is important to me, and finding friends and people that I can interact with on a regular basis, like, it just matters to me now more than it ever has. I think, you know, I'm fortunately in a position where, you know, I'm not as worried about, you know, my 9-to-5 job and finances all the time. And, you know, maybe that might afford me a position where I can think about some of, you know, slightly higher level stuff a little more regularly. But this concept appeals to me significantly. And anyway, long story short, is what these guys are trying to do is they found a community in where one of them lives in Georgia. And it's this self-contained community of 99 existing homes. And they sell for around $50,000, which sounds crazy to most of us in the rest of the country. But, you know, in this part of town, this part of the country and part of Georgia, I guess it's not unrealistic. And these are not dumps. You know, I saw some pictures. They're nice homes. And, you know, but they're small. They're not McMansions. They're, you know, 1,000 square feet or thereabouts. And, you know, what they're trying to do ultimately is get a fund of like-minded people together, investors from the FI community, and actually purchase like somewhere in the vicinity of 20 to 23 of these houses right off the bat. And then slowly, as, you know, rent comes in and cash flow comes in, actually buy up more of these houses. So they go from owning, you know, 23 of them originally to eventually owning 99 of them and turning this into a co-housing community where, you know, realistically, these houses rent for like $650 a month or thereabouts. And, you know, that's something that you never know if that turns into this, you know, mythical FI community that we've talked about with, you know, the likes of Carl from 1500 Days and people like that, where, you know, where this is not going to work for everybody, but maybe 10, 20, 50 FI community members go down and rent houses there, or, you know, eventually buy houses or whatever it may be, and lives in this community. And, you know, it would just be a really interesting experiment. And, you know, honestly, I don't know if this is going to get off the floor with, you know, what David and Stephen are trying to do. But it's a really cool concept. And, you know, it might just wind up that they wind up buying some houses as a real estate investment and it doesn't turn into this co-housing community. But regardless, like, I'm very impressed with the initiative, and it's something that I'm monitoring. I'm not sure if it's something that I'm going to invest in, though we are considering it. But it is a really neat concept, and it's cool that people out there, you know, I know our mutual friend Jonathan Marla and Pete, Mr. Money Mustache, you know, people are thinking about these communities, and I suspect it'll happen eventually. You know, will it happen in Georgia? Maybe, maybe not, but I suspect it'll happen in the next 5 to 10 years where you start getting concentrations of people in the FI community actually getting together and wanting to live together. So it's an exciting thing for me.
And you know, it's kind of interesting how that ties back. If you remember earlier, how we were talking about how expensive it is to live next to the Joneses, and also how powerful it is to live next to someone that's pursuing financial independence. And it's just interesting how obviously you can see the connection there between what you're talking about and what they're considering building, and just that idea that we kind of hashed out earlier.
Yeah. And I think not only will it be the big things like you're talking about, like not having expensive cars or, you know, not worrying about keeping up with the Joneses, but even just little things, right? Like you talk about living in a community. Well, on my block here, we have 10 houses, and I'm sure every single person owns a lawnmower. Every single person owns a ladder. Every single person owns a tool kit. And, you know, some people have exercise equipment. Well, I mean, if you lived in an actual community, you wouldn't need to own that much stuff. There could be shared things. There could be 10 lawnmowers for the 100 houses or whatever it may be. Like, I know this sounds minor, but think about not having to own all that nonsense that you have that just sits idle 99% of its useful life. My toolbox downstairs sits idle 99% of its useful life. The lawnmower, all this stuff. I mean, you talked last time, Jonathan, about the stuff in your attic. I mean, maybe some of that is useful, like might actually have value, right? Or baby toys. You know, you're having a kid in a month, like you have to buy all this stuff, the bouncers, the swings, the right? Like, I mean, that stuff adds up. Or you talk about like—
I've got so much baby stuff now.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's just going to keep multiplying, believe me. And instead of buying $100 bouncer or whatever it is, like there might be— the next door neighbor might have a bouncer. And, you know, in normal suburban life, you feel weird doing that stuff because it's not a conversation that ever comes up. It's just not. Like, there might be a yard sale or somebody might sell something on Craigslist, but there's so little like actual sharing in life. And like, we just waste so many resources buying redundant things. So, I mean, that's like my pie in the sky, like just little things, but just that they add up. So anyway, that's my little tangent, but I think it's a cool concept. I don't know if it'll come to pass, but I think it's cool.
We could also do a whole show just about the benefits, you know, or the possible benefits of this idea, especially for the FI community, just because if you think about it, once you're post FI, working, you know, having your 9-to-5 job is optional, which means you are location independent. You're not tied down anywhere. So there's something about the idea that you're talking about that really is powerful for the FI community. So anyways, we'll leave it for another show. It definitely is a full show. All the benefits and the cons, you know, I don't think you can have one without the other. Could easily fill out a 1-hour segment. And so maybe we'll kick that can down the road just a little bit. But, you know, it's on our minds, which means we share it with you guys. So we're always looking for ways to engage you, to get you information that's relevant. This is continuing to build. It's continuing to grow. We have three times as many people that are listening to us and that are engaging with us this month as we did last month. This is an exponential thing. If you think that this is helping you and you want to share it with your neighbors, do that. I love to share the ideas that I have with my friends and my neighbors. I don't keep this stuff to myself. I share it with everybody. So when you send me a comment saying that you shared it with everybody that'll listen, I do the same thing. And so my neighbors know how excited I get about travel rewards. And I've told them, I want to take a trip. We are all going to go to Cape Town, all six of us. So me and my wife, and then our two sets of friends that are in our neighborhood. And I am going to find out exactly what cards you need to open. I'm going to figure out the order for you. And then we are all going to take a 2-week trip to Cape Town, South Africa. And it is going to be completely free. And this is something that they can get excited about. It has the power to make a difference in their life. So this is information that is relatable. It affects everybody. Middle class America, this stuff is for you. And this show is for you. So we also tend to get some questions every single week about travel rewards. We try to answer 1 to 2 of those each week. Just keep it as a small segment. So that is my single idea. I got that from Marla, who's just awesome at redemptions. And she's been in touch with us. Hopefully we'll get her on a short segment to talk about her vacations that she took this year. But for right now, Brad, I have a couple travel rewards question for you. Are you ready for this?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So Drew wants to know, does Southwest still accept ultimate rewards toward the 110,000 points needed for the companion pass?
No, they do not.
Did they ever? Was that something they did at one point?
Drew might know something that I don't. At least for the last couple of years, those transfers. So just to take a step back and be really clear, what Drew's saying is, if you had Chase Ultimate Rewards points, could you transfer them to Southwest? So Southwest is one of the 11 transfer partners of Chase Ultimate Rewards. Could you transfer them to Southwest and those count towards the 110,000 points you need to earn in one calendar year in order to trigger and earn the Southwest Companion Pass? And the answer is definitely, as of today, and certainly at least for the last couple of years, the answer is no. So unfortunately, so they would count still as Southwest miles. So let's say, for instance, you did earn the Companion Pass separately, and then you wanted to transfer in 100,000 Ultimate Rewards points to Southwest. Well, you could use those points and take advantage of your existing Companion Pass, which would essentially double the value of those Ultimate Rewards points, which is amazing, right? But you cannot, they do not count towards actually earning the Companion Pass. There are, you know, at this point, it's earning them through flights, and it's earning them through the credit card sign-up bonuses and the credit card ongoing points that you earn for your regular spend for a very short period of time through actually the end of this month, through the end of March. There are some transfers that you can do from hotel rewards programs, and the most notable is the Marriott Nights and Flights package. Those transfers do count towards the Companion Pass. So if you're hearing this on Friday and you happen to have 270,000 Marriott points, which sounds like a crazy number, but it's actually, those are pretty easy to accumulate, and you want to get the Companion Pass, you can actually do something where you buy this, essentially buy, you redeem this Nights and Flights package, and you get a 7-night voucher for a Marriott category 1 through 5 hotel, and you get, I think it's 120,000 Southwest miles, which does trigger the Companion Pass. So it's automatic. So this is amazing. For 270,000 Marriott points, you get 120,000 Southwest miles. You get the Companion Pass. So that essentially makes that 240,000 Southwest miles. And you get a 7-night stay in a category 1 through 5 Marriott. So that is a really cool thing that will only be applicable for the next week. Wow. So if you want that, please do your research real quick. And yeah, so that will not be good in the future. And the other just last note in that, since I did spend 2 minutes talking about that, is if you have Starwood preferred guest points, those do transfer 1 to 3 to Marriott. So let's say 30,000 Starwood points is equal to 90,000 Marriott points. So that could help you. If that sounds intriguing to you, what I just mentioned about Marriott, Starwood and Marriott points both count towards that. So this is something, honestly, that Laura and I are still contemplating. We have enough Starwood points to make this happen. We just don't know where we would redeem that category 1 through 5 Marriott. And what's funny is actually Marla, who we've mentioned a couple of times, she just told me that she did this. So it's very certainly on the minds of the top travel rewards people out there that this is an amazing deal. So if you can take advantage of it, you really should.
Very cool. So Ruth wants to know, she says, I would like to start saving up points, but I do not plan on traveling much, at least by plane, for about 3 years or so. So would you just skip the Southwest cards until January of the year you plan on flying more frequently, then bounce back and forth between the Ink and the Sapphire? When my kids get a little older, we'd like to do Disney and then maybe Hawaii or Mexico.
Yeah, Ruth, I think that makes sense. I think that's something you need to strongly consider when you're talking about, you know, what you're saying with the Southwest cards is to potentially, like we had mentioned, to get the Companion Pass just through a couple of Southwest sign-up bonuses. Yeah, I mean, this again is actually something, you know, I didn't mention this a minute ago, but another aspect that we struggle with is getting the Companion Pass, like, and not being able to utilize it as much as you'd really want to make it worth its while. So, yeah, I mean, it doesn't make sense to go through the effort to get the Companion Pass and then not use the thing, you know, especially when you, it sounds like, you know, for sure for the next 3 years, you're not going to travel that much. So yeah, I would definitely get in a points accumulation phase, and, you know, just going for the companion pass just as like a vanity exercise doesn't make sense. And that's certainly, you know, that based on your comments. So yeah, I would shelve the Southwest for a little bit, you know, other than, you know, Southwest points are pretty valuable in general. So, you know, if you want to start stockpiling them specifically, you could, I suppose, but I would stick with the ultimate rewards points from Chase. I think they're just much more valuable. So yeah, you know, most succinctly, I would start racking up ultimate rewards points. So you have, you know, potentially a couple hundred thousand of them when that 3 year time period is coming, and you can start using them.
And Brad, I know that traveling to Disney is something that you are world-class at. We actually created a guide specifically in putting together that Disney World vacation for yourself and your family. You know, just for audience, if you want to check that out, you can go to chooseify.com/Disney. But Brad, I know, like, this is something that is massive, and you're really good at it. So just kind of give people a highlight reel.
I mean, we took our family of four, but also my in-laws came and my parents came as well. So we all did the travel rewards thing for, yeah, the eight of us.
It would have cost you probably close to $4,000, and you essentially did it for, you know, less than what, a couple hundred, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think all in, it was like $150 and yeah, we could have done it essentially for free if we really, really wanted to, but I, you know, 150 wasn't too bad, but
yeah, I think that would probably be worthy of a segment on a podcast, or it's probably about a 20 or 30 minute conversation.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea. Yeah. You know, the travel reward strategy to Disney is actually really pretty straightforward. And, you know, for a lot of families out there, you're going to Disney. And whether you like it or not, unfortunately, and it's big dollar figure. So it could be $4,000 plus for the airfare, the park tickets, and the hotel. And yeah, I mean, there's a pretty straightforward strategy to do it for nearly free. And we are definitely going to talk about that on Chooseify. I think that's an important topic. Yeah, we are really excited for the next couple of weeks. We have Coach Carson coming on. Then we have the Mad Scientist, which is just really a fantastic conversation. I've listened to it a couple times, just getting ready for the show notes and such. You guys are really going to get a lot out of that. Just personalizes him a lot more. And yeah, then we actually have continue the amazing guests. We have JD Roth coming on soon. We have Jim Collins and Jeremy from Go Curry Cracker. So, you know, we have what we like to call like the Mount Rushmore of fire, and they're pretty much, most of them are coming on in the next month. So it's a really, really exciting month here at ChooseFI. And yeah, just to kind of go back to what Jonathan was saying before about like the iTunes reviews, I want to let you know, like, every single day I get up and go to iTunes and check our reviews. It's like I get so much value out of reading them. And I always kind of joke/poke fun at Jonathan for like checking stats. And, you know, I'm like, don't check the stats, because it just kind of distracts from, you know, the important stuff. But I got to say, I check the stats when it comes to those iTunes reviews. I read every single one, and it really does mean a lot to us. So yeah, if you have 30 seconds, just head over to iTunes and leave us a review. So thanks again.
All right, guys. Well, this Monday check-in, it's going to be Coach Carson. We're going to talk about house hacking. No teen should be allowed to make it to the age of 30 without hearing this particular episode, especially if they have parents in the FI community. I tell you, this episode, I have already told my brothers who are kind of in this place where they need to be considering it, you have to look into this. This needs to be something you need to consider when you're picking your first home. It's just, you're leaving too much money on the table by not doing it. That's how powerful this Monday episode is. So listen, get your kids to listen to it. Make sure they understand it. Have a conversation with them about that. If you never make any other decision, if you do this one thing right, this one choice, you make this one choice, house hacking, between the age of 18 and 30, you do that one thing, your path to FI is almost guaranteed. It's that powerful. So listen to the episode, then listen to it again. Brad and I are unbelievably excited about how this one came out. So we cannot wait to share it with you. And we look forward to seeing you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.
Hey everyone, I hope that you're enjoying the archives and you're benefiting from the content and you're taking action. I just wanted to let you know, like, if you're a completionist and you're kind of working your way through the archives, that What we've actually seen is this idea capture the imagination of the world and really become a full-on movement. And what we did is with the first 2 years of content, we actually took all that information and we put it together as a book. And that book is now available to anywhere books are found. I think that it is a phenomenal addition to your library. It would make a fantastic gift for someone that you want to share this idea with. And if you would like to kind of see what are the big ideas, what did we pull away? What do we think that everyone really needs to know about, hear about, and then have that come together in a really compelling story that will really lower the barrier of entry as we discussed and encourage you to take action on these ideas. Check it out. Go to chooseify.com/book to get your copy today.